I hope that you have an armchair in which you can comfortably relax, in which you can lean your head back, and if you have a stool at your feet to rest your legs completely, so much the better. First, though, a little word of introduction.
Hello, you're listening to Voice on Record with me, Sean Williams, on Resonance 104.4 FM in London and resonancefm.com for the rest of the world. So for today's show, we're going to come back to the Reverend George Bennett, whose dulcet tones you heard at the start of the show there. We're going to have a little bit of dialect English from around the UK, including some Pam Ayres later on, some of Aesop's fables read by Boris Karloff, and then the inimitable Blaster Bates. So the idea today is to get a little bit of a range of different English accents and dialects with a good sort of selection of material as well. Undoubtedly, there'll be some poetry every week, since the vast bulk of recorded spoken word is poetry, often from the original authors, who aren't necessarily the best readers of their work, but sometimes it gives you a rather good insight into their way of going about things. And I get a kick out of it personally, listening to some particular poets reading their own work. So without further ado, let's start off with some Scots dialect, since I'm making the show here from Edinburgh.
Edinburgh is a city of contrasts. We have some of the finest buildings, gardens and parks, and yet out of the normal tourist routes, some of the worst slums. The Royal Mile is a hodgepodge of old tenement buildings, lovingly restored by the corporation. And across the other side of Prince's Street, we have the wide streets, Georgian squares and gardens of Britain's first new town, which is now over 200 years old. For 3 weeks of the year, the city hosts the most varied arts festival in the world.
You should listen to these two for a minute. Cursing, slang and threatening each other as Glasgow Nyavs have done in Bobby's bar since dear knows when on the time-worn topic. Who's won the greater number of trophies, eh? Celtic. Admit it, don't be stupid. Rangers taught the world to play football, man. The thin one says he would sacrifice a chance to win the pools just for the pleasure of seeing the fat one hung from Ibrox stand with his own Rangers scarf. The fat one promises to pray that another blade of grass never grows in Celtic Park. They smash the old Irish, Catholic and Orange Protestant arguments at each other's teeth with commendable vehemence. The ritual has been enacted a million and more times, and this current joust seems just like all the others that have gone before, except that the wee protagonist on the left is called Fu Yen, and the fat one on the right, Mohammed.
Well, you know, since the start of this new Inverness-London direct air service every day, it's really first class for a businessman like myself. I can leave Inverness early in the morning, be down London by 10 a.m, get a complete day's work in London, catch the plane in the evening, 6 o'clock, have a nice dinner on the way up and a few drams, and get back into Inverness by, oh, say, 9 or so. Just time to run down to the pub and have a pint and a dram before getting home for the night.
Robert Burns, Scotland's national bard, was an Ayrshire man, and by reputation, he was a great boy for the girls. One fine May morning, he's walking down Village Street in Mauchlin in Ayrshire, and coming to meet him was a nice, rosy-cheeked country lass, a milkmaid, and she was carrying the milk with the old-fashioned yoke over her shoulders and a milk pail in each hand. Burns said, "Good morning, miss." She said, "Good morning, sir." He passed, then stopped and called back and said, "I don't suppose, miss, you know who I am?" "No, sir," she said, "I'm afraid I don't." "Well," I said, "I'm Robert Burns, the poet." "Are you?" said she. "Ah, well then, I suppose I'd better put down my pails."
So there we go. There's some voices from Edinburgh, Glasgow, Inverness and Ayrshire which were issued on the English with a Dialect record of BBC Records 1971. So, as I promised, we're going to come back to the voice that you heard at the top of the show, which is the Reverend George Bennett, who's president of the Divine Healing Mission, the old rectory, Crowhurst, near Battle, Sussex.
The inner springs of life are drained by the constant demands and pressures. They have to be restored. You cannot live life all taut and stretched all of the time. Like a spring which is never relaxed and uncoiled, you've got to have these times. If Jesus needed them, you and I do. So let us begin to relax now. We shall do it on three levels. The levels of the body, the mind, and the spirit. First, then, our bodies. If you like, just sort yourself out a bit on your chair. That's what I'm doing at the moment. Get quite comfortable. Perhaps stretch a little bit your arms and your legs, and then rest right back. Every part of your body. Let it be rested. Your head to your toes, completely relaxed, as though you were a sack of coals which is dumped down and left there, lying with its full weight taken by the earth. I find it helps if you just cross your ankles, and also cross your forearms very lightly, not tight, over your tummy. Now we'll see that every muscle is loosened, every limb, every part of us relaxed. We'll start from our extremities upwards. Just think of them, your toes, ankles, seat, comfortably rested, your spine and shoulders. Take your other limbs, your arms, first of all your fingers, stretch them out for a moment, and then let them flop. Don't clench. Your forearms resting comfortably, your elbows down. Now your shoulders. Drop your shoulders a bit if you can. Don't tighten them up. Drop your shoulders and let your arms go completely dead, completely relaxed. Now your neck and your head, your face. Take the wrinkles off your face. Have your lips just loosely together. Let your eyes droop a bit, if you like. Let the wrinkles disappear from around your eyes and your forehead. Let your face go quite loose. Doesn't matter what you look like. Relax all those little muscles all over. Let your head be resting, completely relaxed. Your whole body is now resting physically, completely relaxed. Now let's take a few deep breaths, breaths that go deep into our lungs, not just the top behind our ribs, but lower down, so that our forearms move up and down as we breathe deep down within. Take about six breaths. Hold them just for a moment before letting them go. Thank you. Now you need breathe only very lightly. The good oxygen you have taken in is now flooding your bloodstream, bringing new life as it courses down through your arteries into every part of your physical being. And because you are completely relaxed, your arteries can do their work better in carrying this life-giving oxygen right through into every part of you, right down into the extremities of your limbs, your hands, your fingers, your legs, your feet. Just relax and let go every part. Completely, physically relax. That means we can go on to the second level, the level of the mind. We want our minds to relax, and so we are going to think positively, peacefully, happily about some particular memory that is stored up in our minds. Our minds are full of so many things, of course, that go right back to our earliest days for some of us. Hundreds of experiences, thousands. Most of them we've forgotten, perhaps, but they're still there. And we can choose any one that we'd like, because really each one is still at this moment a part of us. Even though what happened may be years and years ago, it's still there within. I want you to pick some particularly happy memory. You may have to go back some time, maybe back into childhood if you like. It doesn't matter. It's all part of you. Choose a time, perhaps, when you were alone or in the company of somebody who completely understood you and you were at peace with them. Maybe out in the country, maybe somewhere at the seaside. And I want you to go right back to that particular occasion and to dwell for a few moments right in it. Put it in another way, of course. Instead of going back, you are bringing it up to the present. Try and visualize it. Let everything else go for the moment and just enter into that happy memory. Let's do that now. We go back into the past, and there it is. A peaceful, happy time. Enjoy it gently, slowly. Now, with our minds completely relaxed, let's go on to the third and the last step, the relaxation of our spirits, of our inner beings, our souls. I want you to realize the great unchanging truths. God in His love is everywhere. And to reach out in your spirit into the whole of this universe, which He has made, and be at one with it, with the trees and the plants and the stars, the clouds, the sky, the earth, all this His universe, all His creatures together, and God pouring out His love upon all that He has made, everything. Underneath are the everlasting arms. relaxed and at one with the whole of the created universe, at one with its Maker and our Father. If you like, think of yourself as a sponge floating upon the ocean of God's love. The sponge drifts backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, so gently, resting completely on the ocean, which gives it full support. And because the sponge is completely relaxed, the waters of the ocean are flowing through it, cleansing it, washing it. You are like that sponge. And at this point, we can begin to let everything go. We can begin to let God, in His great love and mercy, take over everything that is in our hearts. Any sense of unfairness about life, we can give to Him. Any frustration, any fears, we can yield all to Him. He supports us as we let go and let God. People we love, we think of them with us in His love. Loved ones beyond the veil, within the reach of His love. Even people we don't like very much, in the realm of His great love. There mustn't be any bitterness in our hearts. We can let everything go, give it all to Him, whatever it may be. Jesus said, "Abide in me and I in you, as the branch abides in the vine, so must ye abide in me." Let the peace of God rule in your heart. Let the joy of God fill your mind. Let the love of God renew you, restore you now. If you like, you can drop off into sleep now, or alternatively rest a few moments longer in Him, and then get up and go on your way. Go then with God's peace in your heart, His life flowing in and through yours. We can do all things through Christ, who strengthens us. God bless you.
Well, I haven't really got a particularly religious agenda here, but some of the things that really appeal to me about that recording are that the very beginning is you can hear the tape starting. There's the evidence that it's been recorded on a reel-to-reel. You get the swoop of the frequencies coming up. And I love all the sort of background noises that are in there. And it almost sounds like the tape's been transferred at the wrong speed, because he seems to have a bit of an unnaturally low voice. All these sort of artifacts really appeal. And I think there's as much history of the technique and the technology embedded in the recordings as there is the actual material of what's being said or read. Anyway, following on from the religious theme, we're going to now listen to some moral tales from ancient Greece by way of Boris Karloff.
On a cold, frosty day, an ant was dragging out some of the corn which he'd laid up in the summertime to dry it. A grasshopper, half perished with hunger, besought the ant to give him a morsel of it to preserve his life. "What were you doing," said the ant, "this last summer?" "Oh," said the grasshopper, "I was not idle. I kept singing all the summer long." Said the ant, laughing and shutting up his granary, since you could sing all summer, you may dance all winter. Winter finds out what summer lays by. A fox who had never seen a lion, when by some chance he met him for the first time, was so terrified that he almost died of fright. When he met him the second time, he was still afraid, but managed to disguise his fear. When he saw him the third time, he was so much emboldened that he went up to him and asked him how he did. Familiarity breeds contempt. An oak that had been rooted up by the winds was borne down the stream of a river, on the banks of which many reeds were growing. The oak wondered to see that things so slight and frail had stood the storm, when so great and strong a tree as himself had been rooted up. "Cease to wonder," said the reed. "You were overthrown by fighting against the storm, whilst we are safe by yielding and bending to the slightest breath that blows." A wolf had got a bone stuck in his throat, and in the greatest agony ran up and down, beseeching every animal he met to relieve him, at the same time hinting at a very handsome reward to the successful operator. A crane, moved by his entreaties and promises, ventured her long neck down the wolf's throat and drew out the bone. She then modestly asked for the promised reward, to which the wolf, grinning and showing his teeth, replied with seeming indignation, "Ungrateful creature! To ask for any other reward than that you put your head into a wolf's jaws and brought it out safe again." Those who are charitable only in the hope of a return must not be surprised if, in their dealings with evil men, they meet with more jeers than thanks. A jackdaw, as vain and conceited as jackdaw could be, picked up the feathers which some peacocks had shed, stuck them among his own, and despising his old companions, introduced himself with the greatest assurance into a flock of these beautiful birds. They, instantly detecting the intruder, stripped him of his borrowed plumes, and falling upon him with their beaks, sent him about his business. The unlucky jackdaw, sorely punished and deeply sorrowing, betook himself to his former companions and would have flocked with them again as if nothing had happened. But they, recollecting what airs he had given himself, drummed him out of their society, while one of those whom he had so lately despised read him this lecture: "Had you been contented with what nature made you, you would have escaped the chastisement of your betters, and also the contempt of your equals." In days of yore, a mighty rumbling was heard in a mountain. It was said to be in labour, and multitudes flocked together from far and near to see what it would produce. After long expectation and many wise conjectures from the bystanders, out popped a mouse. The story applies to those whose magnificent promises end in a paltry performance. A hound, who had been an excellent one in his time, and had done good service to his master in the field, at length became worn out with the weight of years and trouble. One day, while hunting the wild bear, he seized the creature by the ear, but his teeth giving way, he was forced to let go his hold, and the bear escaped. Upon this, the huntsman, coming up, severely rated him. But the feeble dog replied, "Spare your old servant. It was the power, not the will, that failed me, remember rather what I was than abuse me for what I am. As a cock was scratching up the straw in the farmyard in search of food for the hens, he hit upon a jewel that by some chance had found its way there. "Oh," said he, "you're a very fine thing, no doubt, to those who prize you, but give me a barleycorn before all the pearls in the world." The cock was a sensible cock, but there are many silly people who despise what is precious only because they cannot understand it. A man and a satyr, having struck up an acquaintance, sat down together to eat. The day being wintry and cold, the man put his fingers to his mouth and blew upon them. "What's that for, my friend?" asked the satyr. "My hands are so cold," said the man, "I do it to warm them." In a little while some hot food was placed before them, and the man, raising the dish to his mouth, again blew upon it. "And what's the meaning of that now?" said the satyr. "Oh," replied the man, "my porridge is so hot, I do it to cool it." "Nay, then," said the satyr, "from this moment I renounce your friendship, for I will have nothing to do with one who blows hot and cold with the same mouth." A pot of honey having been upset in a grocer's shop, the flies came around it in swarms to eat it up, nor would they move from the spot while there was a drop left. At length their feet became so clogged that they could not fly away, and stifling in the luscious sweets they exclaimed, "Miserable creatures that we are, who for the sake of an hour's pleasure have thrown away our lives." A woodman was felling a tree on the bank of a river, and by chance let slip his axe into the water, when it immediately sunk to the bottom. Being thereupon in great distress, he sat down by the side of the stream and lamented his loss bitterly. But Mercury, whose river it was, taking compassion on him, appeared at the instant before him, and hearing from him the cause of his sorrow, dived to the bottom of the river, and bringing up a golden axe, asked the woodman if that were his. Upon the man's denying it, Mercury dived a second time, and brought up one of silver. Again the man denied that it was his. So diving a third time, he produced the identical axe which the man had lost. "That is mine," said the woodman, delighted to have recovered his own. And so pleased was Mercury with the fellow's truth and honesty, that he at once made him a present of the other two. The man goes to his companions, and giving them an account of what had happened to him, one of them determined to try whether he might not have the like good fortune. So repairing to the same place, as if for the purpose of cutting wood, he let slip his axe on purpose into the river, and then sat down on the bank and made a great show of weeping. Mercury appeared as before, and hearing from him that his tears were caused by the loss of his axe, dived once more into the stream, and bringing up a golden axe, asked him if that was the axe he had lost. "Aye, surely," said the man eagerly, and he was about to grasp the treasure when Mercury, to punish his impudence and lying, not only refused to give him that, but would not so much as restore him his old axe again. Honesty is the best policy. A tortoise, dissatisfied with his lowly life, when he beheld so many of the birds, his neighbours, disporting themselves in the clouds, and thinking that if he could but once get up into the air, he could soar with the best of them, called one day upon an eagle, and offered him all the treasures of ocean if he could only teach him to fly. The eagle would have declined the task, assuring him that the thing was not only absurd but impossible. But being further pressed by the entreaties and promises of the tortoise, he at length consented to do for him the best he could. So, taking him up to a great height in the air and loosing his hold upon him. "Now then," cried the eagle. But the tortoise, before he could answer him with a word, fell plump upon a rock and was dashed to pieces. Pride shall have a fall. A shepherd boy, who tended his flock not far from the village, used to amuse himself at times in crying out, "Wolf! Wolf!" Twice or thrice his trick succeeded. The whole village came running out to his assistance, when all the return they got was to be laughed at for their pains. At last, one day, the wolf came indeed. The boy cried out in earnest, but his neighbours, supposing him to be at his old sport, paid no heed to his cries, and the wolf devoured the sheep. So the boy learned, when it was too late, that liars are not believed even when they tell the truth. An ass, hearing some grasshoppers chirping, was delighted with the music, and determining, if he could, to rival them, asked them what it was they fed upon to make them sing so sweetly. When they told him that they supped on nothing but dew, the ass betook himself to the same diet, and soon died of hunger. One man's meat is another man's poison. A fox had fallen into a well, and had been casting about for a long time how he should get out again, when at length a goat came to the place, and wanting to drink, asked Reynard whether the water was good and if there was plenty of it. The fox, dissembling the real danger of his case, replied, "Come down, my friend. The water is so good that I cannot drink enough of it, and so abundant that it cannot be exhausted." Upon this the goat, without any more ado, leaped in, when the fox, taking advantage of his friend's horns, as nimbly leaped out, and coolly remarked to the poor deluded goat, "If you had half as much brains as you have beard, you would have looked before you leaped." A hare jeered at a tortoise for the slowness of his pace, but he laughed and said that he would run against her and beat her any day she would name. "Come on," said the hare, "you shall soon see what my feet are made of." So it was agreed that they should start at once. The tortoise went off, jogging along without a moment stopping at his usual steady pace. The hare, treating the whole matter very lightly, said she would first take a little nap and that she would soon overtake the tortoise. Meanwhile, the tortoise plodded on, and the hare, oversleeping herself, arrived at the goal only to see that the tortoise had got in before her. Slow and steady wins the race. An ox, grazing in a swampy meadow, chanced to set his foot among a parcel of young frogs and crushed nearly the whole brood to death. One that escaped ran off to his mother with the dreadful news. "And, oh, mother," said he, "it was a beast, such a big four-footed beast that did it." "Big?" quoth the old frog. "How big?" "Was it as big," and she puffed herself out to a great degree, "as big as this?"
"Oh," said the little one, "a great deal bigger than that."
"Well, was it so big?" and she swelled herself out yet more.
"Indeed, mother, but it was. But if you were to burst yourself, you could never reach half its size." Provoked at such a disparagement of her powers, the old frog made one more trial, and burst herself indeed. So men are ruined by attempting a greatness to which they have no claim. A fox, just at the time of the vintage, stole into a vineyard where the ripe grapes were trellised up on high in the most tempting show. He made many a spring and a jump for the luscious prize, but failing in all his attempts, he muttered as he retreated, "Well, what does it matter? The grapes are sour."
A dog had stolen a piece of meat out of a butcher's shop and was crossing a river on its way home when he saw his own shadow reflected in the stream below. Thinking that it was another dog with another piece of meat, he resolved to make himself master of that also. But in snapping at the supposed treasure, he dropped the bit that he was carrying and so lost all. Grasp at the shadow and lose the substance. The common fate of those who hazard a real blessing for some visionary good.
Boris Karloff there reading The Ant and the Grasshopper, The Fox and the Lion, The Oak and the Reed, The Wolf and the Crane, The Vain Jackdaw, The Mountain in Labour, The Old Hound, The Cock and the Jewel, The Man and the Satyr, The Flies and the Honeypot, Mercury and the Woodman, which I think is quite a good one, The Tortoise and the Eagle, Poor Old Tortoise, The Shepherd Boy and the Wolf, The Ass and the Grasshopper, The Fox and the Goat, The Hare and the Tortoise, The Frog and the Ox, The Fox and the Grapes, The Dog and the Shadow, and here's one about a hedgehog.
I am very fond of hedgehogs, which makes me want to say that I am struck with wonder how there's any left today. For each morning as I travel, and no short distance that, all I see are hedgehogs, squashed and dead and flat. Oh, now, hedgehogs are not clever. No, hedgehogs are quite dim. And when he sees your headlamps, well, it don't occur to him that the very wisest thing to do is up and run away. No, he curls up in a stupid ball and no doubt starts to pray. Well, motor cars do travel at a most alarming rate. And by the time you seize him, it is very much too late. And thus, he gets a squashoed, unrecorded but for me, with me pen and paper, sitting in a tree. It is statistically proven, in chapter and in verse, that in a car and hedgehog fight, the hedgehog comes off worse. When whistling down your prop shaft and bouncing off your diff, his coat of nice brown prickles is not effect if. An hedgehog cannot make you laugh, whistle, dance or sing, and he ain't much to look at, and he don't make anything. And in amongst his prickles, there's fleas and bugs and that. But there ain't no need to leave him squashed and dead and flat out. Spare a thought for hedgehogs. Spare a thought for me. Spare a thought for hedgehogs as you drink your cup of tea. Spare a thought for hedgehogs hovering on the brinked. Spare a thought for hedgehogs lest they become extinct.
The lovely Pam Ayres there with a poem of hers called In Defence of Hedgehogs. And now for some blaster baits.
Hey! My God. Well, I think it's got all the makings of a rollicking good evening. I'm going to have to give you some of the old bullshit, I'm afraid, because... after all... Oh, I'm sorry, madam. I'll have a furkle in me back and see what I can find. As I say, it's a simple talk given by a simple boy to a simple lot of buggers, I'll tell you. I brought some of the jelly light with me. You'll notice it's very much like marzipan. Just a job for the mother-in-law's birthday cake. You get her to light the candle and you piddle off out quick. Sorry, dear, I keep forgetting. Somebody open the door for that lady, quick. I lock it. To detonate this, as I was trying to tell Northwich Rotary Club, you take your non-ferrous metal prodder in your right hand. Now, if you have... You then insinuate it in the end of the gelling night, like so. One of these buggers at Northwich Rotary Club, one of the execs in the eye, say, "Hey, say, Mr. Bates, why don't you use our non-ferrous metal prodder? Price 7 and 6p. Well, we've got all the bloody prices with him, you know. I think it sent him a purpose, you see. As did I, but your non-ferrous metal prod is only like a piece of bent copper wire. As in, by the time I've prodded him a couple hundred of these and I have a hole in my hand as well as one in my jelly. As that I'm sticking to the old screwdriver. I don't mind being blown up but I'm buggered if I'm going to walk about with a hole in my hand. Just start looking at you sideways, you know. Yeah. Anyway, having prodded me jelly, we then take a piece of blue sump fuse. This is just a simple way, shall we say, and a plain azide detonator. And having done this, we stick the detonator on the end of the fuse like so, and crimp it on with the approved nippers. One of those things that the sergeant made you say, if you hold it in your hand, it gets warm, it blows your bloody hand off. I had one silly twat say to me, is that why you've got a gold tooth? Can you imagine it, though? Nice, thick as two bloody sharp blanks among them. Anyway, and then we stuff it up the orifice like that, and now we have what you might call a blast bomb. And as I say, do we just say, for instance, we wanted a serving hatch in this wall? And what we do, we notice I point it towards the other stick of jelly. Now, we'll just imagine this was an 18-inch brick wall. Then you light the fuse. The fuse burns down. The detonator explodes. This starts to burn about 4.5 miles a second, which is knocking up. The gelignite changes from a solid into a gas at that speed. It hits the other stick of gelignite, which, of course, acts as a booster. And we hit the wall with a pile-driving blow of gas about 5 miles a second. Of course, people say, well, how'd you go on underwater? I've never had it. Anyway, they get bloody wet, of course. But with this stuff, you will notice I will light the blue sump fuse and we will let it bubble and... Oh, Christ. We'll let it bubble and squeak around in here a bit. And there you are. Look at that. See that there? Now then. I was at one of these religious groups and said, he's a great clever bugger, this bitch. He can't change the water into wine. Said, how's that for a Guinness? It also takes the management 3 days to get the shit off that glass when it's finished. Yeah. And I can only say this. Oh, look at that. Now, you'll notice it come right the way around. There you are, you see. We start to sag when it's nearly finished, getting on the short stuff. In about half an hour's time, there's a most fiendish smell comes off that glass. It's evil. I can only describe it as being evil. It's like ratchet that's gone off, you know. It's bloody awful. It is really fiendish. And I was at the Pack Horse Hotel in Bolton, rather swish place, 3 dining rooms and a string quartet. At the Rotary Club, the men that wear the shoes. And I was demonstrating with this, you know, and I put it on the table, and after a bit, you know, the president said, can I take that off you, you know, because the bloody stench was getting on his pudding a bit, you know. So he buggers off with this, and I thought, he's gone and shoved it down the bog and pulled the chain on it, you know. Anyway, he was back in a minute. He said, oh, he said, that's better. I said, it is. It's fiendish, isn't it? He said, yes, you see, because... Anyway, about 3 days after, I got the letter from the manager of the Pack Horse Hotel at Bolton. We know what it is and who it is, but for Christ's sake, tell us where it is. You know? And this silly bugger had obviously stuck it behind the piano somewhere. And this evil bloody smell, you know... Was going through all the 3 dining rooms. And the bloke was playing the bloody cello, making his eyes water, you know. Oh, he was bloody awful. But as I say, some years ago, I'll have to tell you some of these things, I suppose. It's all part of the bloody treatment. When we were doing that Pudsey bypass, I'll never forget this, though, because... It was seemed so bloody funny to me. And it was Bilton's. They were knocking that road through on that new Leeds Ring Road. Load of rock there was. It was down about 40 foot going between these fields. And they hit this bloody rock. And then they got to knock these trenches out for the soakaway pipe out of the side of the dual carriageways, you know. So knocking these bloody trenches out, doing about 20 yards at a time, you know. Bang! And the machine is pulling the rock out, you see. And one of these big Irishmen was watching me. Big, strong fella. He must have been about 6 foot. Bloody three, this fella. Huge fella. Big Connemara man, I believe. They call him Big Mick from Connemara. He was a big fella. And he was watching me, and he mumbled something. You're a mighty fine fella that invented this stuff, he said. I said, aye. I said, there's a fella named Nobel. He's going back a bit now, about 1875. You know, I'll try to explain it to him. Anyway. Oh, went on blowing this rock, and we're getting down the bottom, and I was walking up, coming up for me bloody lid of tea and me bun, you know. This bloody shadow dropped across me. I looked up, and there he was. Jesus Christ, you'd be a great man in a political organisation. And I could tell he wasn't a Welsh nationalist.
Oh, dear. Political organising.
I said, how's that, Mick? He said, well, yeah, they had me going down at 3 o'clock in the morning. Where was it? Somewhere round Armagh or somewhere. I've forgotten where it was. He said, to blow up a bus station. He said, and all he did was blow three bloody windows out. So he was quite peevish because I wouldn't go back with him and help him out, you know. And I did not do Nelson's column in Dublin. But some years ago, had a bloke not far from here, over by that Kraft cheese place, Middle Witch. He said he got an island in the River Dane. He said, I would be obliged if you'd come and shift it out for me, lad. He said, he'd brought one of them, when the river was up in the winter, he's brought one of them tree stumps down. He said, and then the river's gone down, it's stuck right at the bottom of my field, he says. And it, all the muck's built up round it. He said, and it's caused a big island over about 3 years. He said, and the river's like branching out like this here, and it's wearing my farm away. He said, half acre of my ground's floated off towards North Wicks, you know. Undermining the bloody banks, you know. Didn't he doing the same with my neighbour across the bank, across the other side of the river, he said. He said, and I'll tell you what, he said, if it comes any closer my way, he said, the electric board's going to lose one of them there pylons. He said, and there'll be some blue lights, you know, Mr. Chappell, when that happens. I can imagine about 30-odd thousand volts falling in the bloody river, you know. Bloody blue lights coming down the field. So, he said, can't he do anything about it? I said, ah, I said, I'll come and blow it all out. I said, but it'll cost you about 20-odd bloody quid. He said, well, he said, I said, what shall I do? I said, well, you get on to your mate and the electric board and I'll chuck about 7 quid in a bloody hat. I said, now I'll come and write it off. So they did. I went up there, took a £120 weight of explosives. Took them £2 sticks, dug it all in the iron, linked it all up. Well, I set this off and it was such a bloody clapper, you know. Boom! A shower of shit blew up in the air. And blew off towards Biley somewhere, you know. And he looked at me, he said, hey, lad, he said, I'm glad to see he's gonna be neighbour. Well, he removed the island all right, and they reckon the River Dane is deeper there than it is anywhere now. Between bloody Congleton and North Wick. Made a lovely swimming pool for the kid. Wee, that's a grand job there. Come into the house and we'll pay thee. One of the more benevolent ones you get, you know. So we went in. He gave me this bloody tenner. And we had a cup of tea and I got in my old motor and come down his drive. And as I was coming down the drive, you know, when you pass a plate, you think you've seen it and you think, Christ, that's changed or something. As I come down, I looked at this pub and I thought, I swear that was a black and white pub when I... when I came up, you know, you can't quite place it. Because the bloody thing had changed colour, you see. It was like a dirty, bloody, streaky, mahogany, brown shit colour. And the funny part about it was, it was a bloke with a newly varnished cattle wagon on the car park, which was then the same colour as the pub. I thought, there's a coincidence. A bloody cattle wagon and a pub the same colour. No. Whistling, the sun had come out, you know. But the landlord, this bloke had gone in, it was Tommy Leach, he'd gone in for a bloody drink. and then it suddenly started going dark. And they'd run out because the landlord said it's a total eclipse of the sun. He said, my bloody chickens will go to roost. I shall have to go round the back and lock the buggers up, you know. They'd run out because they'd heard the crack of doom. So I said, crash, the Philistines are upon us. They'd run out, you see. When they got outside, the sun was shining. They couldn't understand it for a minute. Till I got down the end, trying to get a bit of wheel grip to get across the road. Bloody Tommy Leach saw me. He said, that's him! That's the bugger there, he said. It's him for a pound, you know. The hand was in the pocket. So I went across the road. I see you with the landlord. Yes, I am! Look at me, Bob! Look at me, bloody Bob! I said, well, what do you reckon, an act of God? You know. I'm not having that. I'm not having that. Oh, I thought we'll have to humour this bugger a bit. You know. Who's for a drink? So we all go back in again. By this time, he switched all the lights on. We go back in again. I thought, get him something expensive, like a small rum, you know. Anyway, after about half an hour, the bugger had mellowed a bit, you know. He said, I'll tell you what I'll do with you. He said, I've got that bit of land across the road. He said, I've got a dirty old pit in it. He said, I want you here when the wind's in the other direction and clean my pit out. He said, you can blow all the shit all over Witchley's house and see how he likes it. It shows how these jobs snowball, doesn't it?
The inimitable Blaster Bates there from his album Laughter with a Bang, which was recorded live at a meeting of the Congleton Roundtable in May 1967. So what you heard there was the introduction, hints on the use of explosives, a Big Mick from Connemara, Island in the River Dane, and the pub that changed colour. I'll spare you any more of that. So to completely change the subject, but not the period, I've got another record from the 60s. This is from 1961, recorded by the very famous Lansdowne Recording Studios. Famous, of course, for issuing Michael Garrick and Ian Carr, Don Rendell, and lots of the classic British jazz. This is beautifully recorded at Huxley's apartment in Ennismore Gardens in London, and it really captures him in a really relaxed state of mind. He talks about all kinds of things. He responds to the occasional question of the interviewer, but he really seems to be able to just flip from one subject to another seamlessly. So I've got a short selection here. This is actually taken from a CD which was reissued by Artifact Music Limited in 2002.
I started writing actually very young. I started writing when this thing happened to my eyes. When I was about 16 at school, I had this violent attack of keratitis, which I had to leave school because I became practically blind, and I had to learn Braille and to continue my education with tutors. And during that time, I learned to use a typewriter. It was the only way I could write. And then I started to write. I actually wrote a whole novel at that period, which I never subsequently read. And this has disappeared. I rather regret that it has disappeared, because I would be interested to know what it was like now. It was a sort of romantic... it wasn't very romantic. It was a sort of rather bitter novel about... young man's relationship with two different types of women, as I remember it. I discovered that I liked writing, that I had a certain gift for it. And I had, of course, before I went blind, intended to become a doctor. I presume if I had gone on with that, I would have gone into medical research, because I don't think I would have been a very good practicing doctor, but I might have been fairly good a medical researcher.
But why wouldn't you have been any good at medical practice?
I would have been good enough in sort of personal relationships, which I think are tremendously important with in a good doctor. I mean, I was diffident and shy and awkward then. I think I've slightly improved with age. But I don't know that I would have been very good. But I think I would always been very interested in the research part of the thing. But anyhow, I couldn't go on with that kind of scientific career because I couldn't use a microscope or do any of the necessary work in the laboratory. So that this determined my choice of a career, that I had to go into something else. And then I discovered that I could write and that I did like writing. And from that time on, I always wrote a good deal. I wrote when I was an undergraduate. I wrote a lot of verse in those days. And then I also wrote a certain amount of prose. And I did publish my first prose book about 1920, I think, the first book of stories that I wrote.
How did you come to publish? Did you already know publishers, or did you write to them?
Well, I'd published a certain amount of verse in periodicals. I'd published two little volumes of verse with Blackwell at Oxford, and a certain amount had been published, as I say, in papers like The Nation and in art journals of different kinds. And I'd written a certain number of essays and stories which had been published. And I sent my first book of stories to Chatto and Windus, where Frank Swinnerton read them and set his seal of approval upon them. And I've been with Chatto's ever since. I've always enjoyed it. I've always... it never come very easily. I mean, all my thoughts, in a sense, are second thoughts. I tend to write everything over again. But I like it. It's laborious, but it's work which I find very rewarding and extraordinarily interesting. I mean, this seeking the right way of saying something. And I must say, I was very interested not long ago in looking over an old volume of essays which I'd written while at Oxford for my tutor. I took the English literature at Oxford, and these were essays on all sorts of literary subjects, I mean, from Chaucer down to the present day. And I was interested and surprised to find that I was writing quite well at that time. I mean, that I had a certain feeling for style, and that there was even a certain elegance in what I was doing, even at the age of 20, that I had, obviously, some kind of natural gift for writing, and although, as I say, it's always been a considerable work for me. I mean, it's this. I never get the results I want, except as a result of careful correction and going over and rewriting. I don't work out anything in great detail. I mean, I sort of start a thing, and then it becomes clear that this has to be done, and I reach a point out in front, and therefore this means something that the back has to be changed, and it develops in this way. I don't work out a thing in any elaboration in advance.
Aldous Huxley there from 1961, and with such a mellifluous voice, I find myself able to listen to that really just without any regard to the content at times. It's such a beautiful accent that you just don't really come across anymore, and thank goodness for the foresight of people that actually commissioned these things to be recorded. Well then, just time to leave you with a few words from Peter Scott and some of his feathered friends. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Tune in next week to Resonance FM, 104.4 FM, resonancefm.com. I've been Sean Williams. You've been listening to Voice on Record. Bye-bye.
We've got over 100 different kinds of ducks from all over the world at the Wildfowl Trust. Here are some of them. that shows that ducks don't only quack.